Robin Hood Radio presents Agriculture from Tucana Farms. Here's Mark Scherzer.
Every year about this time, I marvel at the burgeoning life force that engulfs us. In the floral world, perennial spring bloomers like snowdrops, crocuses, aconites, tulips, daffodils, and butterbirds have pushed out of the often still hard ground and through the leaf litter, with the smaller plants already in bloom. The willow branches are visibly green while the forsythia branches are showing yellow. Inside the greenhouse, its warmth intensified by the ever higher angle of the sun, the spinach is already on its second cutting, and some arugula is already going to seed. The artichokes are energetically surging upward and outward. As to the fauna, the udders of our sow possum are filling, and she will, we anticipate, produce another litter of piglets in a week or two. The enduring virility of the old boar Vernon, about to be a father yet again, is a great comfort to me in my golden years. Our best laid plans of the fall to postpone lambing into April by isolating the ram in a separate pasture was for the most part successful. Nonetheless, we had one small lambelanche, six lambs born to four ewes, about 4 weeks ago, and another isolated pair of twins born 2 weeks ago. These early arrivals most likely resulted from surreptitious visits by the ram to the ewes' side of the pasture, and evidence the irresistible power of sexual desire which cannot be denied. The reasserting life force manifests itself orally as well as visually. As I sowed the early spring cool weather vegetables in the vegetable garden last weekend, I became aware for the first time this season of the intermixed and distinctly spring-like songs of the various breeds of songbirds, whose absence Peter had lamented recently. They are back. I could also hear in the pasture to the east the distant bleats of the youngest lambs, seeking out their mother's teats, concealed by heavy winter coats, from among the 35 adult ewes in the flock. From the pond to the west, I could make out the muffled splash of the Canadian geese as they landed, on their way to the island, where each year at this time, they returned to hatch their brood. And as the afternoon progressed, these sounds were joined by a rising chorus of peepers, those tiny tree frogs in the nearby woods. They make their annual appearance around the equinox, their eerie echo melody rising and falling on the breeze in waves of response. The chicken yard, especially on sunny days, abounds in happy spring sounds as the chickens cluck and pick at the bushels of winter-hardy weeds we've been hauling to them from the garden. The clucking is punctuated by the occasional feisty crow of the rooster, who wanders about and mounts squawking hens in quick and violent sexual release. When the sun is shining and these sights and sounds and even the smells of spring populate one's sensory world, it's hard not to feel a sense of calm well-being and even optimism. Yet as Peter, or my therapist, or many of my friends will tell you, I have a hard time just basking in the moment. Bask for a few seconds, sure, and then the dark underside of the present creeps in, followed in short order by fear of what the future holds. And what is the dark underside of burgeoning life, if not its ever-accompanying antithesis, energy-sucking death? Death has been with us, too, this spring, in a raw and brutal fashion. The happy sounds of the chickens in their coop and songbirds in the trees generally greet us when we emerge from the back door of the house. But if, when we emerge, there's silence, we know that something is amiss. About 3 weeks ago, late on Saturday morning, I went out to the garden to do work and immediately was aware of a creepy silence emanating from the coop, usually the most vivacious part of the farm. A silence as noticeable as a loud noise would be. Although their coop door was wide open, I could see no chickens out in the yard. Approaching, I realized why. Immediately in front of the coop door lay the eviscerated carcass of a beautiful large older hen, ripped fully open, partially eaten, with her deep red liver and some yet-to-be-laid eggs exposed to view. It was a grotesque vision, raw in its vivid colors. I've seen enough dead animals not to have felt revulsion or shock, but the image was nonetheless jarring. I felt we had been invaded and was concerned for the rest of the flock, who were clearly deeply traumatized. On such a beautiful day, when they would normally be hunting, pecking, and taking dirt baths, they were suddenly invisible. Some were huddled in the corner of the yard under a cover of a thick vine. Most were inside the henhouse, under the table on which their roosting perches are affixed, standing still and silent. Though we think of animals as having short memories, more than half of the hens stayed under the shelter of that table well into the following day. What they witnessed must have been brutal. The songbirds that nest in the vines over the chicken yard and in the rafters of the coop were similarly silent and invisible. After some discussion, Peter and I deduced that this carnage was likely the work of a predatory bird. The attack happened in the daytime, so it wouldn't have been a nocturnal predator like a skunk, raccoon, or possum. Fortunately, the death toll was only one, unlike the frenzied attacks that massacred dozens of our hens a few years earlier, confirming that this was not the work of a fisher cat. That the carcass was half-eaten right on the spot was either too heavy for the predator to drag off or too big to slip through the gap in the outer fence, suggested that it was unlikely to have been the work of a fox, which would have been hunting to feed its kits back in the den. And that the songbirds were similarly silent and invisible suggested that they had also been potential targets of the attack. That was further evidence that a predatory bird was the culprit. Among the possible predatory birds, owls were unlikely since they are usually night hunters. While eagles might take such prey, they hadn't been much of a presence around the farm of late. Hawks, which are plentiful, were clearly at the top of the suspect list. Two Saturdays later, history repeated. Again, much to my dismay, a hen was killed, but this time I surprised the predator before it could begin devouring much of the bird, and I saw the red-tailed hawk fly away, confirming our suspicions about who the culprit was. Later that same day, I saw the chickens rushing for cover, spooked by something they sensed above, but which I couldn't even see. What to do about this now recurring hawk predation presents us with something of a dilemma. As the creatures that live by hunting emerge from the deprivation of winter, they will, like all other forms of life, seek energy to breed and build their own families. When much of their usual prey, such as field voles, is still in hibernation, they must look elsewhere for food sources. And what better place to look for the nutrition they need than a nice fat hen that's been nurtured by us through the winter? We're caught between recognizing that their predation is the cause of their natural process of spring growth and our responsibility to protect our birds. When I voiced some sympathy for the hawks, Peter, ever the realist, replied, "What are we supposed to do, just let the hawk pick off a chicken every Saturday?" I suggested we try protective measures such as netting over the chicken coop yard, and Peter pointed out that while we could easily net the top of the relatively small winter chicken yard, the far larger summer chicken yard would be almost impossible to cover with aerial netting. The meat chickens and the young turkeys and the geese that we keep out on open pasture, too, all summer would be even more vulnerable. It was Peter's understanding that farmers have the right to protect their livestock by eliminating predators. It turns out that may apply to some types of predators, but not to red-tailed hawks. I called the New York Department of Environmental Conservation and spoke to a regional wildlife counselor who told me the DEC would never give out a permit to take out a predator bird. He told me that in some special circumstances, the federal government, through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, could do so for certain birds, such as blue herons, but he didn't know whether they would for hawks. I called the USDA, and the person who called me back, who's also a farmer based in Columbia County, told me that such permits were theoretically possible to obtain from the Region 5 office in Hadley, Massachusetts, but that in fact they pretty much never issue such permits. Given that the red-tailed hawk population is stable and not in danger, he thought there'd be a good argument for selective permitting and suggested concerted lobbying through the Farm Bureau. But clearly that's a longer-term solution when we have an immediate problem. If eliminating the offending hawk turns out not to be an option, and even with a permit we could probably not do it with the skills and ability we have, we are left with a few alternatives. We can net where we can, and in other places we can hang shiny metal strips or old CDs on lines above the foraging birds. Such shiny metal objects apparently deter hawks from swooping down on their prey. We might also buy some large and bright blow-up owl figures. Hawks fear owls, and if an owl appears to be hanging around, the hawks will avoid the area. But aside from netting, such measures are apparently only partially effective. We have to hope, instead, that the life force of our farm exceeds the life force of the hawks. We hope the trees hasten their leafing out, providing greater cover for our chickens. We hope the voles in the pasture are fruitful and multiply, offering the hawks tasty alternatives. And we reconcile ourselves to the notion that for life to thrive, some death is necessary as well.
Peter Davies and his partner Mark Scherzer are proprietors of Turkana Farm, specializing in heritage breeds of livestock on their 40-acre farm in Germantown, New York. Peter also presides over Turkana Odyssey, in which he customizes cultural tours of turkey for small groups, which he calls an insider's view of turkey. And his third hat is Turkana Gallery of Old and Antique Kilims, which he operates in the Wall Street area of Manhattan. Mark presides over his law firm, Mark Scherzer Law Office, which specializes in health law, also in the Wall Street area. Their farm website? TurkanaFarms.com. Their email, farm@TurkanaFarms.com, or 518-537-3815.